KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, President Trump will now be able to get judicial and administration nominees through the Senate much faster after Republicans on Wednesday detonated what's been coined the nuclear option to cut debate time on nominees from 30 hours to 2. It's the third time in 6 years that the majority party in the Senate has dismantled longstanding rules. We'll look at what effect this is having on the Senate and how the changes are ensuring that the impact of the Trump presidency will be felt for decades. We get started after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In an effort to speed confirmation of President Trump's nominees, Senate Republicans voted this week to shorten debate on district court and non-cabinet-level appointments, angering Democrats. Here's Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
What Republicans really want to see is the elimination of yet another norm of the Senate so they can automate and expedite the nomination process without a modicum of debate. They're all for consent with no advice.
A red-faced Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, defended the move.
There's nothing radical about this. He acted like it was a sad day for the Senate. You want to pick a sad day for the Senate, go back to 2003 when we started filibustering the executive calendar, and he started it. That was a sad day. This is the glad day.
It's the second time McConnell has used the so-called nuclear option to change Senate rules with a simple majority vote, and it's the third time it's happened in 6 years when Democrat Harry Reid detonated it in 2013. We'll look at what they did and the impact of this week's moves with Molly Reynolds. She's Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. She's also author of Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. Good morning, Molly Reynolds.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by David Levine. He's a professor at the UC Hastings College of the Law. Good morning, David Levine.
Good morning, Mina.
And we have Gregory Koger with us, professor of political science at the University of Miami. He's the author of Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. Good morning, Gregory Koger.
Good morning to you.
I will start with you, if I could. So first, could you just explain what the Senate did by cutting debate and why it's being considered such a big deal?
What the Senate did is decide on both executive nominations and judicial nominations that only 2 hours of debate will occur once a simple majority of the Senate has decided to shut off debate. So a nomination comes up, and then there is a cloture vote, and then there's up to 2 hours of conversation afterwards. Now, I should note that this excludes cabinet positions and Supreme Court nominations and appellate court nominations, but all the, you know, hundreds of other positions are now entitled to up to 2 hours of debate, but no more in the Senate after a cloture vote.
And so what's the impact of shortening the debate by 28 hours after a cloture vote?
It dramatically minimizes the amount of time that it's required to process nominations. So you can now process, you know, as many as 15 in the same time as it used to take to process a single nomination.
And it's
so the Senate can work a lot faster to put more judges on the federal bench and put more executive nominees in their jobs in the executive branch.
And it's something that President Trump has wanted. No, Gregory Koger, we've heard him say, go nuclear, Mitch.
That's right. I mean, the president has been calling for a complete elimination of the filibuster since he got into office. And so this is part of what he was asking for. I mean, as you say, the Senate has already decided that it takes a simple majority to invoke cloture on nominees in the past. And so that's already been done. It's now a question of how long that debate period goes on, which is, I mean, it's an underappreciated part of the cloture process in the Senate because, I mean, it's one thing to say that, you know, a simple majority can shut off debate, but if that debate then goes on for 30 hours, that's a long amount of time to just keep the lights on in the Senate and nothing really happening while they process a single low-level nomination. And so just the threat of wasting all that time was a deterrent to you to bring up some of these nominations.
Yes, and that is what Mitch McConnell said in terms of his justification, Molly Reynolds, for invoking this change, that he was forced to by the obstruction of Democrats. What was your reaction to that?
So I think it's worth remembering that the conflict that we see in the Senate over judicial nominations is not exclusively a recent phenomenon.
No.
It goes back into the 70s and 80s. It's not just something that's arisen, say, post 2000. And that the time from nomination to confirmation for district court nominees has actually been increasing for roughly 30 years. So, you know, Majority Leader McConnell made the argument that at this point, Democrats had forced his hand. But a lot of the trends that he cited and that get talked about as to why the Senate might want to reduce the amount of time available after cloture has been invoked, those aren't especially recent trends.
Yes. I mean, I don't think we have to look very far back to remember the name Merrick Garland and how, you know, Mitch McConnell played a big role in obstructing his nomination by President Obama when he was, in charge of the Senate by not even giving Merrick Garland a hearing.
Right. And so, again, the idea that the federal judiciary is a site of intense partisan conflict in the U.S. Senate is not something that's just started in the Trump administration. It is true that for Republicans, the federal judiciary is sort of a particular site of partisan conflict. Confirming conservative nominees to the federal judiciary has been a very important part of what Republicans have been up to since 2017. That's in part because they haven't been terribly successful at doing things legislatively. So even when they had control of both the House and the Senate, they didn't have a terribly robust legislative agenda that they could work on. And now that Democrats control the House of Representatives, now that they have a majority, the prospects for real legislating by Congress are relatively low, which makes the idea of spending more time in the Senate on confirming lifetime judicial nominees perhaps even more attractive for Republicans.
So David Levine, as Molly Reynolds explained nicely, they are really focused on the judiciary as a place where Republicans can leave a lasting impact beyond Trump's tenure in office, depending on how long that lasts. Could you give us a sense of how many vacancies the president has been able to fill, you know, at the Supreme Court level is two, but even at the appeals court level, and now with the shortening of debate at the district court level, kind of what potential exists for him and what he's already been able to do that's pretty dramatic.
Sure, Mina. Well, I mean, there's a lot to it. Let me just rattle off a couple numbers, which I just happen to have here. President Trump has, besides the two Supreme Court justices, he's gotten 37 judges on a lifetime appointment for the U.S. Courts of Appeals across the country, 54 district court judges. Now, he's got 57 district court nominations that are in the pipeline, and that's what Senator McConnell wants to get done ASAP. But there's a total of 129 vacancies on the district court. That would include the 57. Now, the entire district court, federal district court across the United States, 673 authorized. So what that means is if Mr. McConnell and President Trump jam all those nominations through 129, that means about 30% of the district courts in the United States will have Trump nominees for life.
Now, can you just compare that to what other presidents have been able to do in terms of the speed and the number?
Sure. Let's look at President Obama, and let's look at Senator McConnell slow walking President Obama. So obviously Merrick Garland is exhibit A, B, C, and D. But the number I have is for the Court of Appeals, is that President Trump in 2 years has gotten 37 Court of Appeals nominations on the bench. President Obama in 8 years, 55, and toward the end of his administration, almost none. So it's been dramatically different. So Senator McConnell has been really putting in the bank these nominations, the vacancies, and now he wants to work with the president to get as many of these nominees on the bench again and again, because they've been using very young people. This is for a long time.
That's what I was going to ask you. So they are focused on young judges so that they can sit for a long time. But, I mean, are they far right? Are they very conservative? Are they more moderate?
2 out of 3, yes. By and large, it's, you know, pretty far right people. And one of the concerns has been that you are talking about very, very conservative people, and some of them with very little trial experience. Occasionally, a couple have failed. And really, it's, I think, of Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana. He's the one who has asked some very, very good questions about, son, have you ever tried a case? And the answer is no. So they've gone more for ideology in many, many of these cases rather than the sort of nuts and bolts experience you really want to have, certainly on the trial courts.
The Federalist Society is an entity that comes up a lot as being the unit that has basically influenced President Trump's nominees. Can you just briefly tell us who the Federalist Society is?
Sure. Federalist Society started around 30 years ago. Justice Scalia, when he was a professor, was one of the people. Judge Bork, when he was a professor, was some of the people who started it. Ed Meese from California was also one of the people early on. So part of they have had a project, which is to shift the thinking in the judiciary. Things like we hear about strict construction, we hear about original intent of the framers, all of that all comes from the Federalist Society pushing and pushing. And so what we've seen now is that for several generations of law students and then experienced lawyers and then judges, they have been put in the pipeline, groomed, and then now we have inside the White House somebody like Don McGahn, who was White House counsel, a member of the Federalist Society, and essentially subcontracting the looking for the short list of nominees from the Federalist Society. They're incredibly important to this process.
And if you could just briefly talk about the impact of appeals court justices. I think we focus a lot on the Supreme Court, but now you're saying he has, you know, many dozens of potential placements on the district courts, but then also on the appeals court. So just help us understand the power and influence that they have in our country.
Sure, of course. So on the federal judiciary, we've got roughly not quite 900 people and authorized. The lower courts decide the vast majority of the cases. They are deciding tens, hundreds of thousands of cases every year when you include the courts of appeal across the country plus all those district court judges. The Supreme Court is going to take about 70 or 80 cases to be decided. Now, we focus on those because those are very important issues. But the vast majority of work that is done on the federal side of the judiciary is done at those lower levels. So for the vast majority of people filing in federal court, it is those levels and that's it. They're not going to the Supreme Court. An infinitesimal number of cases will get to the Supreme Court.
And have circuits flipped from liberal to conservative under Trump's tenure already?
There's been shift in that direction. On the Ninth Circuit, let's look at those numbers. Just a year ago, it was 13 had been appointed by, of the active judges, had been appointed by Republican presidents of all sorts. They were, so maybe a third of the active judges. But that's the recent numbers, 13 out of 29. But just a year ago, 16 Democrats and 6 Republicans. So there's been a shift. And again, there are vacancies and more people coming down the line. So you're starting to see those shifts in some of these courts, moving from more moderate Democrat controlled because President Obama had all those nominations. And now it's shifting back. And we're just going to see that more and more.
So, Gregory Coger, was the idea to allow for lengthy debate around nominees and judicial nominees designed to require or try to promote more bipartisanship, more agreement around who the judges were, and thus more moderate judges?
Well, so the cloture rule itself dates back to 1917, and the main change here was in 1986. And the idea was just – so when the rule was originally written, it was built with all these safeguards to make sure that no nomination or bill would be railroaded. And so, you know, you file a cloture petition, you wait 2 days, and then you can vote on it. And then there's plenty of debate afterwards. That 30-hour limit was set in 1986. And the idea is, well, 30 hours is plenty of time to talk about whatever bill or nomination that you've got. But also, you know, brings the debate to a reasonable end. And so, I mean, one of the reasons the Republicans acted is they felt like for the low level nominations that that we're talking about in the executive branch and district court judges, you don't really need more than 2 hours.
And would I venture to say that you agree with them on this, just based on the way you've been describing it?
So this was actually there was a short-term standing order put in force like this in 2013 at the behest of the Democrats. So at one point, it was something the Democrats wanted and thought was a fair rule. And what the Republicans have done is essentially made that temporary rule that was in place for two years of the Obama presidency, they've made it a more permanent rule and in place during the Trump presidency. So if a fair rule is something that both parties want when they're in power, then, I mean, there is a tinge of fairness to it.
Well, Molly Reynolds, can you compare what was done this week with the nuclear option that was invoked by Harry Reid in 2013 and then by McConnell in 2017 related to Supreme Court nominees?
Sure. So they're obviously all similar in that they represent instances where the U.S. Senate used a method of making procedural change that only requires the support of a simple majority of 51 senators. But I would say that there's a qualitative difference between the moves in 2013 and 2017, which reduced the number of votes you needed to end debate. So basically meant that a nominee, either to an executive branch position or to a judicial position, could be put, you could end debate on that nomination with a simple majority. You needed fewer votes to move the process along.
Typically 51.
Yes, so it's 50. It's 51 to end debate, and then again 51 to actually confirm the person to the position. This change that was made this week is more about setting the terms for debate. So instead of allowing a maximum of 30 hours to go by, now we have a maximum of 2 hours. And so I think that's an important difference. In some ways, I think it means that the consequences, the kind of practical consequences of the change that were made this week aren't perhaps quite as big as the one that when we reduced the number of votes needed. But in terms of thinking about the long history of procedural change in the Senate, I do think that what happened this week kind of opens up a new and a little bit different avenue for potential future changes in terms of saying, look, we are we're using the so-called nuclear option. We're using this 51 vote approach to procedural change to shape the terms of debate, not just the number of votes needed.
Why are they able to do this, Molly? I mean, I guess it strikes me as so easy to invoke the nuclear option. Why is it so easy to change the rules in the Senate?
So I think that on one hand, it's actually not easy as a political question. You know, we particularly when we think about the 2013 case on reducing the number of votes needed to end debate for lower court judges and executive branch appointments, that change was a long time in the making. There
yes.
were several other episodes before that where we talked about maybe it was going to happen and the sides threatened to do it. And then groups of senators came together and avoided the change. So I think it's a political question using the nuclear option isn't always easy. As a procedural question, it's basically a reflection of the fact that there are a number of different sources that govern how the Senate operates. One of them are what we call the standing rules of the Senate, the Senate's formal rule book. But a second are what we call the Senate precedents, or the guidelines that fill in the blanks for things that about things that aren't spoken to in either the standing rules or another source of procedure. And we know that those precedents can be set and changed with only 51 votes. So that's the avenue that they went through here. There's not we're not talking about a new rule written in the Senate rule book. We're talking about a change to the precedents.
Well, how central then would you say David Levine has the requirement of 60 votes previously for nominees still existing for legislation? How central is that to the functioning and the philosophy of the Senate?
think it is very central because the idea of the Senate has always been that you would have debate that would be less partisan than the House of Representatives, which does purely operate in a bare majority fashion. That, you know, the metaphor is always that the Senate is the saucer and the House of Representatives is the hot coffee and you're supposed to cool it a little bit. And this takes away from that, because if you have 60, you need to have a little bit of consensus in the middle. Think of the cabinet officers who would not have been confirmed under President Trump if we had the 60. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh would not have gotten through. One other thing I wanted to briefly throw in here is and the other two might want to weigh in, is the question of the blue slip process. And what that means is that the chair of the Judiciary Committee has had an informal role, at least. I'm not sure it qualifies as a precedent, but certainly an informal role, that the home state senators of any nominees, certainly district court nominees, could have a say. Effectively, that was like a veto or a hold. And it then required some negotiation.
So you mean if they did not want this person, they could submit a blue slip?
Literally a blue slip, which would indicate, I'm not on board with this, and it would require further negotiation. So I think, in part, the 2 hours versus 30 hours is procedural. It doesn't seem like such a big deal. But to me, it's that behind the scenes change where there's less collaborative work going on. So, for example, we have two senators on the Judiciary Committee, Harris and Feinstein, and they are not happy with this, because that means that both Court of Appeal judges who are nominated, who would normally be sitting in California for the whole Far West, district court nominees, they are not having a say in the way it has been in the past. So it's that behind the scenes change that I think then bubbles out with this change in debate, because it means there's even less time to have that kind of informal collaborative work so that you can kind of refine the sandpaper the edges, let's call it.
But you're hearing Democrats talk quite a bit about how the Senate is changing, how McConnell is changing the Senate in dramatic ways. Do you think that the invoking of the nuclear option is fundamentally changing the role of the Senate in our government?
I think when you put all these things together, I think that there has been this change, that instead of having that sort of time for collaboration. So I see this as part of the puzzle. And I think Professor Cougar's right that it's not that big a change in and of itself, but it's just part of this larger pattern where there's less collaboration, less time together to work these out.
We're taking a look at the impact of Senate moves to change rules, speed through nominees, reduce the number of votes required to approve them. All with David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, Molly Reynolds, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and Gregory Koger, a professor of political science at the University of Miami. What are your questions or comments about this? Do you think that it's time to do away with the 60-vote requirement for legislation, which is something that's being talked about now that we're seeing it having been taken away for nominees? Or do these changes to Senate norms worry you? Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. I'm Mina Kim. More Forum after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. President Trump will now be able to get judicial and administration nominees through the Senate much faster after Senate Republicans voted Wednesday to reduce the amount of time lawmakers may debate district court and non-cabinet-level appointments from 30 hours to 2 hours. The move was the third use of the so-called nuclear option, a procedure that allows the Senate to change rules with a simple majority vote. But some Senate watchers predict that it is just one more step toward eliminating the filibuster entirely and perhaps changing the Senate. We're talking with David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, Molly Reynolds, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and author of Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate, and Gregory Koger, professor of political science at the University of Miami. He's also the author of Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. And we're also talking with you, our listeners. listeners about this question. What do you think about the changes that happened this week and that have been happening since 2013 related to 60 vote requirements, reducing the amount of debate time, whether it's changing the Senate and its role in our government, whether or not you think it's actually time to do that, that these are rules and norms of a bygone era. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And Molly Reynolds, one of the things that this week's events has prompted, as I mentioned, is that there are concerns that this will do away with the legislative filibuster. First, remind us what that is and why some people are saying it could be on its way out.
Sure. So the legislative filibuster is the requirement for most pieces of legislation in the Senate. That means that to end debate on that piece of legislation, the Senate needs to get 60 votes in order to do what we call invoke cloture or end debate. The conversation about whether the legislative filibuster is not long for this world maybe accelerated a little bit this week. It's not a new conversation, and certainly we've seen a number of the Democrats who are running for president ahead of the 2020 election be asked about this on the campaign trail. And from that perspective, I think it reflects a recognition on the part of many Democrats that if a Democrat wins the White House in 2020, even if Democrats take control of the Senate, which they obviously don't have right now, the chances that they would get a 60-vote majority in the Senate are very, very small.
Yes.
They had a 60-vote majority in the Senate relatively briefly in 2009 at the beginning of the Obama administration, but that's the last time we saw a party in the Senate have that many votes. And so then the question
becomes... Yes, and there's a limited number of competitive races that would make that viable.
Exactly, exactly. So the math problem to get to 60 is a pretty difficult one. So the reason this has been a conversation, I think especially on the Democratic side of the aisle in recent weeks and months, is this question of if a Democrat were to win the White House and Democrats were to have control of the House and the Senate but not 60 votes, would it be worth eliminating the legislative filibuster in order to accomplish certain policy priorities that that kind of Democratic coalition would want to see enacted.
And that a Republican minority would never support things like the Green New Deal, maybe Medicare for All or gun safety.
Right. So certainly some sort of especially progressive priorities. But I think that one thing that many Democrats would argue is that when you look back at the Democrats' experience in 2009, when they had a large but not quite 60-vote majority. The idea that even things that they thought they might get potential Republican cooperation on, that was very difficult to do. And so even putting aside the kind of most progressive policy ideas, that even on some things that would simply move policy to the left from where it is now might be difficult to get the support of any Republicans on.
So basically, you're saying that Democratic presidential candidates are being asked if they support the nuclear option for legislative.
If they support eliminating the legislative filibuster.
I see. And do we know if there's any on record saying that they would?
So I think folks have come out with a number of different answers. I believe that Elizabeth Warren came out this morning with one of the more forceful statements potentially in favor of eliminating the legislative filibuster. But in general, I do think this is something that we're going to see talked about over the next 18 months quite a bit.
Well, is there anything going on now, Gregory Coger, that you would say are steps toward eliminating the legislative filibuster within government? I mean, excluding this conversation with our Democratic presidential candidates.
Well, I think a point that Dr. Reynolds made earlier is applicable, that these three reforms made by the nuclear option process over the last 6 years they're laying the groundwork for a majority in the future to use the exact same process to expand, you know, to reduce the cloture threshold to 50 or 51 on legislation as well. So, I mean, we're seeing a death by a thousand cuts of the existing cloture rule. And the next step would be a frustrated majority saying we'd also like to pass our major legislative initiatives without having to bargain with the minority party.
And if you were a betting person, would you bet that that was going to happen?
If the Democrats take the White House and unified control of Congress, I expect them to do something to make sure that their agenda is not stopped in the Senate. That could be changing the threshold for legislative bills to simple majority, or it could be some other some half reform that doesn't completely eliminate the 60 vote threshold, but say makes it more difficult to filibuster so that it's hard for the Republicans to actually muster 41 people to maintain a filibuster.
And would you support, I mean, you wrote Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. Do you think that it is time to do away with the filibuster?
So as Professor Levine mentioned earlier, I mean, there is a way that the Senate ought to work, and it ought to be bipartisan. It ought to, I mean, and there was a reason why filibustering existed for the first 100 years of the House and has existed to this point in the Senate. It is a way to make sure that there is fair deliberation on the floor, ideally, and is a way to make sure that there is sort of moderate bipartisan consensus on what passes. So that's the classic argument for the filibuster. I mean, the problem is that, you know, if the minority party is using the filibuster just to block everything the majority party is doing, to deny the majority party any wins, anything that they can, you know, put on their credentials, if that's their logic, then it's hard to explain to the majority party why they should allow all of their legislative agenda to fail because the minority party that actually agrees with a lot of the agenda just doesn't want them to accomplish anything. And so once, you know, once we move past the classic argument for bipartisan consensus and we get into a chamber that is so partisan that legislating becomes a zero-sum game, it's hard for a majority party to see the logic of allowing the filibuster to persist.
But do you not see our political partisanship changing in the future? Do you think it will always be like this then, that we are in a new political reality?
It is possible there'll be some, you know, external change in the way our parties work. I mean, if one party just became dramatically less popular then sure, then it might change its legislative strategy and watch the other party implement its popular agenda. But we haven't seen that in recent years.
Well, Nigel writes, limiting debate to 2 hours feels corrupt, and it is corrupt. It's the wrong solution to a bad problem. We need a way to ensure that people who make claims can back up those claims with proof in a timely manner and that frivolous claims won't be entertained for political reasons. Let me go to Lasimba in Oakland. Hi, Lasimba.
Hi, good morning. I want to first say thank you for bringing up this subject. I think it's very important. But I also want to just point out the fact that, you know, most democratic nations in the world are working with a system of more than at least five parties, and we're still stuck on two. And the longer that we continue this behavior of team politics and A versus B, you know, it's really only going to continue to degrade the systems that were put in place within the Constitution, because ultimately they're just going to be playing faction against each other to whittle away to make it easier for one party or the other to get an advantage. Can you guys speak to any way of how we can actually further the bringing in more parties into our system? Because from what I've heard, and I'm not sure if this is true, that in order for primary elections to have the debates to have more than just the two major parties, there needs to be a certain percentage of votes to get a third party in. Again, I'm not sure, so maybe if you guys could clarify, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks, Lasimba. David Libby?
Sure. On the question of debates, I think those tend to be set by the people who are sponsoring the debates. To some degree, it's the television networks as they do that. But we have had third parties on the stage in 1980 and in previous years. We have had them there. The problem is having enough of a critical mass where it seems worth it to have the third party. I think more local elections, you do see more candidates. You do see a Green Party. You see New York State for a long time has had four major parties. So that's part of it. But it's the voters. If the voters don't vote for those third parties and don't make them viable, then we're not going to have them. But on the flip side of, it would be better in other places, I'm just going to point quickly to two examples. How's it going for England right now, or Britain right now, with Brexit, and that they can't come to some plan? And part of it is because of the way it's so splintered. And look at Israel. Look at how, because there are many parties there, look at what Prime Minister Netanyahu has had to do to maintain a governing coalition. So it isn't necessarily the panacea. And nothing's perfect, but maybe more voices would be good.
Well, Marcia writes, if we get to see all the evidence on all the crimes, immoral and corrupt actions and behaviors of the current resident in the White House, including the full picture of the extent of influence by and collaboration with foreign entities, could a case be made that his nominations and executive actions are not viable and therefore be undone? Molly Reynolds, this is assuming Marcia's premise. Would that be the case?
So I think it's important to remember that, you know, what we are talking about here and this change to Senate procedures is, again, the culmination of a much longer history. And it's worth kind of putting it in the context of what's been happening in the Trump administration, specifically, as Professor Levine was mentioning before. You know, President Trump has been able to put a historic number of new appellate judges in place. There's a large number of district court vacancies that they may yet be able to fill over the next 2 years. But it's really this. I think the question here is really about sort of thinking about the Senate and what's its role been.
Yes.
And that has that's really a much longer story than just happened than just what happened this week, and really a much bigger story than just the Trump administration.
Well, let me go to Alex next. And Alex in San Francisco, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to take issue with the gentleman from Miami's language about this. He seems to want it and to have the argument in both directions. And it's really frustrating that he continues to use language like these are only rules that affect low-level nominations. That they don't deal with low-level things in the Senate, and it seems very like vacant marketing language that disrespects the audience and the terms of this debate.
Well, Alex, let me ask Gregory Coger to explain. I mean, by low-level, you're using that as another way to explain non-cabinet-level appointments by the administration, Gregory Coger?
That's all I mean. Yes, so there's hundreds of nominations for executive positions that go that require Senate approval. A small number of them are cabinet level, and the rest are, pick a different term if you like, but they're not cabinet level.
But that said, Alex's question makes me think about, are we going down a slippery slope here? I mean, how soon could it be that, say, we apply the two-hour debate rule, for example, to circuit court judges?
Now, that is a great question, because as we know, I mean, in 2013, the precedent put in place by the Democrats specifically excluded Supreme Court judges from the simple majority threshold. And that lasted right up until there was actually a Supreme Court nomination before the Senate and a majority party that wanted to get its nominee through. So, yes, having taken this step for district level judges, it would be, the next possible step would be to apply the same threshold to circuit court judges. And the majority party would make the same argument, and we'd probably have roughly the same votes.
And the more often you do it, the easier it is. I wonder if even the term nuclear is the correct term anymore, Gregory Coger.
That's right. Well, I mean, it's the original term nuclear option applied in came up in 2003, and the idea was if this ever happened, the retaliation from the minority party would be so vitriolic, so overwhelming that the majority party would regret the wrath that it brought down upon itself. And I mean, clearly that's not the case, that the majority party has made a calculation in this case, as it has in the previous two cases, that they'd rather get these nominations through the Senate as quickly as possible by simple majority vote and incur whatever punishment the Democrats have to dole out, which is not as important to them.
Well, there was certainly rhetoric to that extent, but in terms of actions, it sounds like you're saying they've clearly adopted it. Well, Wendy tweets, Mitch McConnell has already destroyed all comedy, bipartisanship, and historical norms of the Senate for the sake of GOP power. Democrats must adjust to this reality and take steps to grab power back. We talked about this as being a feature of the presidential election in 2020, and the candidates already being asked about this. But I guess I have a couple questions about that. One is, how strong do you think that voice is, David Levine? And also, do you agree with this person that the damage is done, that Mitch McConnell has already gone so far?
Well, on the latter, I mean, I do think a lot of damage was done, and that at some point he will no longer be Speaker and somebody else will be Speaker, whether it's a Republican who steps up or whether it's a Democrat who becomes the next Speaker. And it would certainly behoove us to have see that person, I think, help to move things back into the center. It's the same on the House side. I would lay a lot of this at the feet of Speaker Newt Gingrich, who very deliberately set about trying to drive wedges in there. So I think that's a piece of it. And again, it's a short-term versus long-term. Do you think it's more important to get your short-term victories on the field, or is it more important to steer a more moderate course where people have a chance to interact with each other? And to me, again, the debate part of it is per se not, to me, such a big deal. It's while the Senate is open and nothing else is happening, people can talk to each other in the cloakroom that is just off the floor. All 100 senators are not sitting there like Mr. Smith goes to Washington in rapt attention of what the junior senator from Nebraska has to say about this. That part is just to create the opportunity for debate. So if it's only 2 hours, they can't talk to each other. That, to me, is what's key.
Well, Molly Reynolds, do you agree?
So I think a couple things that are important to note when we think about the future of the legislative filibuster. One of them is that the getting rid of the filibuster only gets you so far if the party that is in the majority when this happens doesn't necessarily agree on the underlying policy agenda that it might want to enact. And so I think one big question between now and 2020, frankly, for both Democrats and Republicans, is if you were to eliminate the legislative filibuster, is there a policy agenda that a simple majority of either party agree on and would want to get enacted? You know, we saw in 2017 when Republicans under unified party control attempted to repeal the Affordable Care Act using a set of procedures that weren't subject to the filibuster, using these special budget reconciliation rules that meant a filibuster wasn't on the table. And they couldn't get it done. And that was in part because there wasn't consensus on what they wanted that legislation to look like. And so as we think ahead towards a potential future where the legislative filibuster might be threatened, I think it's really important to ask ourselves, is there a policy agenda that a simple majority of the party is united behind that would be worth eliminating the filibuster in order to enact?
Yes, the Republicans under unified government is a good example that they were not able to get through major policies. And we are certainly seeing divisions among the Democrats around bold policies as well. And so, yes, there are a lot of questions about how big an impact it would really have to get rid of the legislative filibuster. But the other thing that I just wanted you to quickly touch on, Molly Reynolds, is aren't there already ways to get around the legislative filibuster?
Sure. So absolutely. So there. So for most legislation in the Senate, the filibuster is still a binding constraint. But there are kind of exceptions to that. And I just mentioned one of them, the budget reconciliation process, which has been a really influential tool that both parties have used for the past 40 years to enact certain budgetary legislation. parts of the Affordable Care Act, Clinton's welfare reform law, the 2017 Republican tax bill. It was what Republicans used unsuccessfully to try and repeal Obamacare in 2017. There are also other procedures that we've seen used periodically that also don't subject legislation to a filibuster. A great example that we saw used pretty heavily in the beginning of the Trump administration in the beginning of 2017 or procedures under something called the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to vote to repeal regulations that have been issued by the executive branch. And those votes in the Senate, again, aren't subject to a filibuster.
Have you been seeing what you would describe as any kind of substantive shift in terms of the balance of power between the executive and legislative branches as a result of these things being used a lot?
So certainly if we take a broad historical view over the latter part of the 20th century, we see Congress repeatedly delegating authority to the executive branch. In some cases, when Congress does that, when they give authority to the executive branch to make some set of decisions, they do so with these special procedures in tandem in the Senate to say, look, we're going to give some authority to the executive branch, but we're going to provide a way for us in Congress to try and check that authority. What I think we've seen in the past several years is folks in Congress, in the Senate in particular, using those procedures that they've given themselves to try to check the president to make even symbolic stances against the president, even when they know it's not going to have any real consequence, when because whatever they're voting on under these special procedures still requires the president's signature or enough votes to override a veto. And, you know, we saw this over the past year or so towards the regarding the U.S. policy in Yemen. So several times over the past year, Congress has voted in the Senate more than once to cut off support for U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. And the reason they've been able to do that is because of these special procedures. And even if it the president isn't on board with that policy change and vetoes the resolution and there's not enough votes to override, it's still an important tactic that the Senate has available to it to take a stand against the executive branch.
Well, let me go next to John in Concord. Hi, John. You're on.
Good morning. My comment is about the effect of a group called ALEC and how it just doesn't ever make the news. And when you look at voter fraud, voter ID, abortion, and this happening in the Senate, the effects of the Koch brothers and ALEC, are their footprint is all over it. And they've been writing the legislation. They've been planning things like this for almost 40 years. And there's where the unity of the Republican Party comes from, and it issues like this. And it's a conspiracy that has been affecting our country in horrible ways.
Gregory Coker, do you want to respond to John? The effect of lobbyists, the importance of them.
Yeah, he's just specifically talking about the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is, in my understanding, helps conservative state legislators to communicate with each other and sort of exchange policy ideas. Let me just recommend a book on this topic by Dr. Alexander Hertel Hernandez. He wrote a book called State Capture, focused on ALEC and its allied organizations and their ability to promote a legislative agenda, conservative legislative agenda across state lines. There may not be enough news stories about it, but there is real research going on tracing the effect of ALEC and organizations like that at the state level.
Well, John, thanks for the question. And as we've talked about how the Senate is changing the relationship of the Senate with the executive branch, I'd like to go back to you, David Levine, on kind of where we started, which is how the changes in the Senate are helping to push changes in the judiciary. So could you tell us how you see the judiciary potentially changing as a result of the changes that have been implemented in the Senate around judicial appointments?
Sure. Well, I would say a couple different things. One is that on these hot button issues, it really matters who the judge is, because they really come in with a very different lens. And especially if you're picking people because of their ideological predilections, whether it's left or right, and there you can point to examples in both directions over the years, so that where you come in on something, so, you know, we could just rattle off the normal hot button issues, on abortion, on LGBTQ rights, whether there should be a religious exception for the proverbial barbers and the cake bakers and all that. A very important case that just came out of San Diego regarding California's proposition limiting the size of gun magazines, of the bullets. And it was a very pro-Second Amendment decision. And that's the sort of thing that we would see more and more, even in the lower courts as
yes.
well as the Supreme Court.
We just have 30 seconds
sure.
left. So I guess what I mean is that we like to believe that the judiciary is a more apolitical body and that the rule of law will always prevail ultimately. Do you think that that's in danger based on the makeup of the courts now and what it will likely be by the end of 2020, say?
I think they all say that they try. And it's the proof is in the pudding when you get to these hot button issues. And so we'll just have to see it play out.
But meantime, we can expect to see a lot more nominations coming through the Senate at high speed.
No question about it.
David Levine, a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, thanks for talking with us. Thanks also to Molly Reynolds, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And also to Gregory Koger, professor of political science at the University of Miami. He's the author of Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. And Molly Reynolds is the author of Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. Thanks again to all of you. And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Another hour is next, so stay with us for that.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.